All right, what up, everyone? We got a live stream Jawcast episode today with Carter. Carter signed up for a one-on-one chat with me through my site. There's a link in the description if you want to sign up for your own chat. I see Carter right now. I've never met Carter before. I'm about to bring him in, and I'm going to let him lead the conversation since he's paying to talk to me. We're going to talk about whatever he wants to talk about. All right, y'all, here's Carter.
Hey, how's it going, Ron? Can you hear me?
I can. Nice to meet you, Carter. How's it going?
Nice to meet you as well. Yeah, so far having a good day. Just wanted to check in on the sensitivity of the mic, though. I can change it real quick. If this is ideal, though.
It's pretty. It's a little bit, maybe clipping a little bit.
Oh, really?
Maybe just step away from it a little bit, or get it another 6 inches away from you, if that's possible.
Yeah. How about now?
Yeah, I think that's fine, man. Yeah. Okay. That'll get the job done for sure.
Okay. Cool. Well, yeah, thanks for making the time to speak today. I've been watching your videos for a long time now, but in the past couple of weeks, you seem to have been releasing more and more content that's definitely vibing with me. And I appreciate all the work that you're doing in this space. You know, you really got that dog in you to, to expose this situation and help people out develop, you know, their jaws to the, or, you know, orthodontically or dentally to their maximum biological potential. And that pursuit, I'm really starting to become more invested in, possibly even from a political angle. But I don't want to dive into that too much right now. I really scheduled this call because I wanted to understand my situation, with my teeth a little better. I'm definitely not as educated as some of your other guests, I'd say. And this is something that's been on my mind for a while, but I've started to explore it a lot more in depth. And so essentially, I just wanted you to take like an evaluation of where I'm at currently right now, and then see if you can present some options for me that I could therapeutically treat this. Or if this is something that's kind of helping me gauge whether this is something that is actually realistic for me, or if it's something that potentially the solutions aren't ideal at this point in time and I should take more of a watch and wait approach on this. And what's really sparking a lot of this for me is the aesthetic elements of it. I definitely understand the significance of that, or wanting to improve the relationship between your maxilla and your mandible, and improve forward growth. I've definitely, you know, based on videos that you've presented and just kind of checking out the manosphere and the black pill parts of the internet and the red pill parts of the internet, the arguments that they're presenting, and the looks community and things like that, the arguments that they're presenting on how all of these different attributes of your face influence people's social perceptions, or just perceptions of you, whether it's attractive, you know, whether they find you attractive, or just whether they, whether you have like that pretty privilege. I do think, you know, not to go on this whole tangent here right now, but I think that is very significant. And it's something that we brush to the side, maybe a lot of the more normies or blue pill people, but I do see the significance of that side of the argument as well. And that's something that, you know, but that's not at the forefront of my mind at this point in time. Because when you're experiencing health issues, or what you find to be health issues, that starts taking precedence over the situation. So that's where I'm at right now. I feel like the relationship that I have with my jaws, between my maxilla and mandible, and then also the dental side of things as well, not just skeletally, is impacting a lot of different facets of my life at the moment, particularly around my sleep quality and how I'm sleeping, and just general discomfort I have with my neck, maybe a similar issue to you, that you have in that regard. So I guess next steps on your end here, do you want to like see my mouth and,
yeah, why don't you give us a big smile and show us what we're working with here?
So I do have my wisdom teeth out, and that's another, before I show too much more, I do want to say, like, what you've presented on wisdom teeth extractions is something that I felt strongly about ever since I had my wisdom teeth amputated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I immediately recognized afterwards, I was like, that is something that I should not have done. And I was sleepwalking into it, right? And I got pressured into it by my family, weirdly enough, like my mother and my grandmother and my dentist. We're all pretty adamant about this and made it seem like this was a necessary step that I had to take. And I don't mm-hmm. want to badmouth all these people, but that is the vibe that I got from it. And I was at a young age, you know, 18. But I will say they were extracted very smoothly. Interestingly enough, I had no pain afterwards at all. And I felt like the whole situation resolved itself, and the healing, it all happened within just like a few days, and I was entirely back to normal. Like, I didn't even need painkillers or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Same with my wisdom teeth extractions. I remember the day that I got my wisdom teeth out, I was 15 years old. That night, I went on a blunt cruise with my friend, and I was just like, wow, I can't believe, like, I feel good enough to be like out on this Friday night, like smoking a blunt. But like, yeah. No, I mean, sometimes wisdom teeth extractions go real smooth.
Yeah.
Sometimes, man, they go real bad.
Right. And I'm trying to understand that a little more. Maybe you do have some insight to share, but I think it's because they weren't, I don't really know the academic terms here to use, but they weren't really rooted. Well, they obviously have the roots, but they weren't cemented in there yet. They were very, mm-hmm. the oral surgeon even said these were so easy to extract. So I don't necessarily know exactly what that means, but they hadn't cemented into that root yet or something. Maybe.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm just speculating, but perhaps alveolar bone is a little bit like concrete. And when concrete is fresh and they call it green, they say it's green, it's much softer and it's easier to still nail things into it without having it crack, and pull things out of it also without having it crack. So maybe the younger you are, the less likely you are to have complications with wisdom teeth extractions.
Right. And I think another thing that might have played a role is I went through puberty very late, and I was still growing at like 21, 22. And so it's possible that the bone hadn't really that, because does the bone also play a role in cementing, like once it's erupted fully?
Mm-hmm.
Is there something that stabilizes that tooth then in that formation? Something also I've wondered, man, I'm kind of going over all over the place right now.
That's okay.
But what's one thing I'm wondering is when the wisdom teeth erupt in some instances, does that cause, like, you know, distraction, osteogenesis? Is that what it's called?
Yeah. Like,
you know, that appliance.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Can the wisdom teeth also like push or help the bone grow as it's erupting, but it kind of already has the roots in there, doesn't it? So that's what I'm wondering.
I would suspect that it could help the jawbone grow, maybe, but more often than not, probably it just causes crowding and it pushes the teeth instead of the bone. Because the teeth will give in before the bone, so they're more likely to get pushed around and crowded, bunched up, or the wisdom tooth itself will just not give to the force of the rest of the teeth in front of it. More so than I think the jawbone itself grows forward, but there could be some of that.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing to potentially just keep on our radar.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing is for sure is that wisdom teeth are not to be extracted in vain.
And that's that. I believe that was the case with me. I didn't have any crap. What I expressed was, oh, I'm feeling some pain because they were erupting. And during that process of eruption, there's tissue damage occurring and things like that. So there's a minor amount of pain associated with that. But anyway,
and we have a pretty, I'm just going to throw this comment up from Karen. He says the mineralization of third molar's root was found to start at the age of 15 and the root was fully formed at about 20. So both of us were definitely in that green stage of the roots of the teeth.
Right.
You know, so I guess having them out early is terrible for the development of your face, but probably better when it comes to complications.
Ease of extraction.
Surgery.
Yeah. Because yeah, I remember my mom telling me, oh, I got mine out too late. And there was so much pain associated with it. She got it out later in life when it had already like fully rooted. I don't know what term we want to use for this, mm-hmm. but she had a lot of pain and not necessarily complications, but it was a sustained healing process where for me, I was really good to go the next day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I also noticed my mother has a really robust, fully developed, like almost primally developed upper and lower, her maxilla and mandible have amazing growth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that had been on my mind at one point, because her wisdom teeth had like fully erupted and stabilized potentially. I'm not sure how much of a role that it played, but anyway, let me show you the situation that I'm dealing with in my mouth.
Okay.
So this is, oh, sorry, Maya.
Okay.
So you can see actually.
Yeah.
See how these molars mm-hmm. are kind of concaved in, you know, or pushed in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to add some context here. I had braces when I was 13 to 16. And I had a Herbst appliance during this time, actually, to help with my underdeveloped mandible. And I think it did actually play some role in helping me achieve some forward growth, but it was pretty minimal. But then I had braces again, because I recognized there was something wrong. I have a pretty deep bite, if you look here. Not super deep. It doesn't look super deep, I believe, because it's being camouflaged partially right now by my my incisors and what are these two referred to as again?
The upper incisors.
Yeah, the uppers. Yeah, they were like reclined backwards during the second time that I got braces. They used like a power chain or something. And this is where I felt like a lot of damage was being done. These teeth never really felt the same. Like they feel maybe a little looser, and it feels like there's just some internal discomfort there because of this aggressive power chain. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that technique for reclining the teeth mm-hmm. backwards, using like it's not just the brackets. Then they put like a chain on that pushes them back as far as they possibly can. Really, it seems like, at least.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I felt a lot of discomfort and pain from that, even after I got my brace off. And I also felt like during this second time that I got braces, that these molars were also pushed in a way, if that is even possible to do. They were like, the pressure was applied to them, and I'm not sure what happened there, but I felt like my bite changed deep in my molars after getting braces a second time. And during this time, this was when I was like 20, 21, I was still growing during this time. So I think there was an opportunity here for still possibly some facial growth, but also more of an opportunity to regression to possibly occur. I'm not entirely sure during that time, but I do feel like I shouldn't have gotten braces this second time. And it did make my dental situation a little more challenging for me to deal mm-hmm. with. Mm-hmm. But I had initially gone to this dentist, or this orthodontist, sorry, with like a plan. I was like, I do want to see if we can move, change the relationship here. And he promised me like the world. And then when it actually came to the treatments that was being applied with just brackets, and there was really no appliances being used and anything like this, it just felt like such a cookie cutter approach. And I got bamboozled into something that I'm not sure I really felt like I ever really agreed with. And I didn't really know what my options were after I got my braces off or anything like that. I'm like, what's the next step here? This didn't improve my situation. I felt like it made it worse. And now I don't trust these orthodontists. Like, I went in he said one thing and then literally did something different. Like, I think there's almost be an opportunity to litigate here. I don't think there is, because they are able to write these contracts in a way that mitigates pretty much all responsibility on their end. But
when was this last treatment, and how old are you now?
I'm 29 now. So this was 8 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. The statute of limitations on that is way up anyway. There's no litigation will be happening on that.
Right. And it's really, it was a lot of verbal. It was, you know, there is a written contract that you sign, but a lot of this agreement on what we would do for the treatment was verbal.
So what are you unhappy with about the way things are now? Tell me about the current status of things.
Visually look too concerning, but
you look wide to me. I agree with your last statement. Is when I take a quick glance at you, things are definitely wider than most people I talk to.
Yeah, it's when I bite down, it doesn't feel like that bite platform is great, personally. Mm-hmm. And I think it has something to do with the positioning of these molars in the back. Mm-hmm. And it feels like when I bite down, that's there's definitely some biofeedback or something that's missing there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's hard to actually get a good angle of this.
What are you trying to show us?
These molars in the back here.
The bottom, the lower molars?
Yeah. Because it's like my top molars aren't really in a position to bite down on these bottom molars very well.
So when you do bite, is there contact?
Yeah.
Is it the position of the mandible that you're not liking? Is the mandible feeling recessed back?
Yeah, the mandible is definitely feeling recessed back. And I notice what I do oftentimes, just like another guest that you had on your channel. Can't remember what his name is now. He was also wearing glasses, but he kind of moved his mandible or his maxilla forward a little bit, almost unconsciously or intentionally, possibly.
So you're talking about when he relaxes, his lower jaw slides forward?
Right, yeah.
Does yours
and
do that?
I noticed that's what, like, this is where I'll keep my mouth at when I'm not biting down. Always. Yeah. Like, it's just, that's the most comfortable. And what I saw you do in that last conversation that you had is you were trying to say, oh, it's possibly problematic for the TMJ, the joint there, to be positioning your maxilla forward slightly. But you showed a very exaggerated version of that where you're like this. But really, for us who do this practice oftentimes of moving our mandible forward a little bit is more like this.
Mm-hmm.
Fixing the deep, it's not this exaggerated. So it doesn't actually, my TMJ joint doesn't feel uncomfortable in this position. And this is where I am when I bite down.
So what would you say, 2 or 3 millimeters recessed?
Yeah, that seems about right, which does seem pretty minimal, but I do think those millimeters can make actually a pretty drastic impact on your bite platform and the stability of your bites and the harmony of your bite, and have like a downstream impact on many other areas.
So you want to liberate that lower jaw to come forward. Do you think that's the root of your discomfort with your occlusion, is your lower jaw being recessed?
I also think it's my maxilla is not fully developed either. And possibly it's like rotation or something in regards to that is slightly off. But yeah, I want to see how I can improve this situation for myself, and especially on the lower palate or whatever we call that. Not the upper. I think the upper palate possibly needs a small amount of expansion as well. But I don't want to be like ashamed or embarrassed by this, but I want a primal bite platform. You know, I'm looking to pursue not necessarily like biological excellence, but I want to improve this situation to the maximum extent that I can. And it's not some, like, I think some people might say, you know, that you're going above and beyond, it's not necessary at this point, but that's not the psychological mindset that I have at this moment in time. But with that being said, I wouldn't say that I'm, you know, obsessing over this 24/7, but it is something that I would like to address. And I'd like to draw on your subject matter experience to see what opportunities are available for me here.
So I think
on the lower palate.
I think when it comes to trying to solve problems like yours, the outlook of, oh, I want a primal palate, or I want to optimize my caveman skull, is it's a good ideal to have out there, but it's not a practical philosophy to work with when it comes to actually achieving things from an actual orthodontist using therapies that are existing and available. So with your case, I would say if your primary complaint is that your mandible seems a little bit recessed, then I would say the question then becomes, how do we move the maxilla slightly forward to liberate the mandible to come forward those millimeters that we need and then make that bite permanent and stable for you? I don't think we should be thinking in terms of, oh, where, what's the ideal position of my maxilla in my mandible? Because that inevitably leads us to MSE, MSDO, and then double jaw surgery, which is what all of us really need at the end of the day. But for your case, just at a glance, I would say maybe a little bit of MSE with some face mask, pull the maxilla forward a couple millimeters, let the lower jaw slide forward a bit, and then bake that in with some orthodontics to make that bite permanent. At a glance, that's what I'm seeing.
Right. So for the distance or the palate, I might have missed something there, but the lower palate, how could I like move the position of these molars to fit the, like, geez, it's almost like going in.
You mean they're tipped in?
Yeah.
But is that the problem, or is the top problem that the whole lower jaw is too far back?
That they're, I think they both play a role for, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. So tipping those lower molars out is easy. You can do that with Invisalign. Any orthodontist can do that.
Right. That's not a skeletal thing, really. That's just a dental adjustment. Yeah.
Yeah. That's okay. Just buccally, really buccally tipping the molars.
Yeah. I was still a little abstract to me, to be honest with you. I was trying to build a mental model on if this was just a dental thing or if this was more of a skeletal thing. But that makes sense that that'd be a pretty straightforward thing to address.
Yeah. So consider the fact that most MSE patients, the way that they get occlusion back after expanding the maxilla 8 millimeters is they just take those lower teeth and they tip them buccally, exactly as you're describing. They take those lower teeth and they tip them out. Very common orthodontic movement.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah, that's definitely on my radar now of how to address that. And when I'm like scheduling consultations potentially with orthodontists, that's, you know, coming into that conversation with some knowledge there, I think will help facilitate a strong conversation.
I think that the more interesting question, though, is how to get your lower jaw to slide forward, yeah. Right? That's the real challenge here.
Because something that I've been investigating, but I don't fully understand yet, is the teeth, if they don't contact each other, in some instances, the teeth will continue erupting a little bit.
That's correct.
Yeah. So if I were to get my occlusion with an appliance or something to this, will all of these teeth and the molars and shit erupt a little bit to remodel the occlusion?
I don't think you can depend on that happening in a reasonable time frame. No, I don't. As an adult, as a 30-year-old, you can't just, I wouldn't count on passive orthodontics for anything. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can just, so first of all, how would you even reposition your mandible forward like that permanently? I mean, every time you chew, right? Every time you eat food, you're going to be opposing that hyper eruption of the teeth.
Yeah, I mean, when I was wearing a Herbst device, that was one device that did reposition the mandible, and it prevented contact between the upper and lower teeth. Not the incisors, but definitely the molars.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's one appliance that will create that distance vertically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. I don't know how much growth is possible or how much these teeth will actually erupt and if that will actually lead to a more optimal occlusion for me. But I noticed, not to jump to a whole different subject here, but I feel like this improper occlusion is impacting my sleep and impacting my ability to mew properly at nighttime. I don't feel like I have enough distance quite yet to get the correct tongue positioning on the upper palate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It feels so tight in there still a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible, but there is enough room for me to get my tongue up in there. So something that I am going to try is seeing if I can create the intermaxillary something with the palate.
Intermolar width?
Yes. I think that's what it is. The horizontal distance on the palate, that's the intermolar. Okay. Yeah. So I want to see if I can use my tongue essentially as a natural palate expander, like it's supposed to do, to create a little more of a distance there just by using my tongue.
I don't think that's going to happen. That might happen over a 5-year period, but that's not going to happen in a 1 or 2 year period.
Do you feel like that can pretty much be said conclusively at this point?
Yeah, I do. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Right. I mean, you'll tip your teeth if you mew firmly enough, maybe in a shorter time frame than that, but all that you're really doing is tipping the teeth a little bit, and even still that occurs extremely slowly and not in a stable way, unless you're really psychopathic about your mewing. If you really want maxillary width, the way to do that these days is with MSE.
Right.
It's so easy and available and so fast and predictable. It's a little messy, but I mean, compared to trying to mew your maxilla wider, it's an order of magnitude more powerful, faster, more predictable, and so on and so forth.
Right. And obviously the only thing that is a little off-putting, it's not even super invasive, especially if you don't do the surgical MSE, but it's not necessarily the most straightforward approach, possibly is the most straightforward approach actually for a person in my situation, but it does sound a little more, it's the next step for me personally at this point in time. But I think for a lot of us coming to this conclusion that mewing alone is not going to increase that distance in the majority of adults, it's kind of like a process that you have to accept maybe for some of us.
Yeah, it is.
We want that to be a solution here. And it does, it makes some degree of sense that this is a natural palate expander and that you can use the tongue. You know, it's a very powerful muscle and you can use it to shape your palate.
Right. And there's a certain amount of
adolescents, more in juveniles.
That's correct. And some people report differently. You know, some people say that mewing can achieve more dramatic results in adults, but I just haven't seen it. You know, a lot of people are using thumb pulling now as a way to sort of augment mewing, right? They'll take their thumbs and they'll actually, you know, try to stretch their bone with it,
like
right? Yeah, exactly.
Oh, interesting. Huh. Almost like a headgear type of thing or something. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like using your thumbs as a headgear.
Gotcha. And, hadn't come across that yet.
And people are doing that. But I'm sorry, there's someone spamming the fuck out of my
yeah, no worries, bro.
Out of the, I've just been fighting comments for the last 10 minutes. It's probably
this is live streamed, huh? Right.
Yeah, it's live streamed. Right. Yeah, someone is just, it's probably you know who, just blowing me up like he always does. Fuck him, he's a piece of shit. But whatever, let's not let him disturb our chat too much. but
it'll probably... that shirt though that you got there, bro. Do you have a merch store or something quite yet? Or
I did have a merch store, but they weren't shipping for like 2 months, so I had to pull the store because like people were basically getting scammed by, and it was like a Spring Tea, which is like a YouTube affiliated merch dealer,
right?
But you know, it was like 2.5 months to receive the items. And so I had to pull it, man, because people were starting to get upset.
Interesting. Yeah. But I do feel like you are kind of cultivating maybe like a movement here a little bit. And there could be some merch opportunities for you down the line. I would rep a Jawhacks t-shirt for sure.
Yeah. But, yeah. Thank you, man. I appreciate that. Hang tight a second, bro. I got to just kill these comments.
Yeah, no worries. The next thing that I wanted to bring up, and I'll give you a second, but was on sleeping posture.
Yep, we can talk about that.
And I've seen some of the videos that, that you've made on this. And this is really where the crux of, I think, a lot of my concern lies in, that I really want to optimize my sleep, because when I get a good night's sleep, and I get, you know, not just a long amount of sleep, but where I can really tell it was a restful night of sleep, potentially in some deep REM sleep, I wake up, dude, and I feel like I'm firing on all cylinders cognitively.
Mm-hmm.
And that I'm trying to kind of optimize myself biologically right now. A major element of that is your sleep that you get into. And for my, I'm a software developer as my job. And that is a very sensitive, your cognition, you're really aware and in tune with it because there's such an impact if you're not getting a good night's sleep. If you were out the night before drinking, you're very aware of how this is impacting you mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I get 8 hours of sleep consecutively for a few days, I feel like a different person psychologically and mentally in every single way possible. And I'm realizing, man, this is something that you need to start figuring out in your life, is how to get good sleep. And if you've been having issues with that or have been chronically sleep deprived, don't kid yourself on the impact that this is having on your life. I don't want to become an evangelist on this, but I really do think that there is a lot more here than meets the eye. And I know a lot of people have started recognizing this, but I find it to be absolutely profound. And these things that have such force multipliers on our life, like getting your jaws in the correct position, getting your sleep habits, to me, that almost does, it's starting to feel like a political pursuit. But let's not go down this whole rabbit hole right now. But that's where my priorities are and my focus is.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels weird to say that right now in this kind of climate and this social climate and things.
Yeah, like how that. Do you mean? I'm not sure I understand.
Well, like what if there was more of a political focus to figure out some of these problems that are, I think, really originating at the clinical level, right? So right now we're exclusively talking about orthodontists and dentists, but I think that this, I don't know, I don't think saying, oh, it's this problem is the right way to frame this situation, but I'm finding a lot of instances where physicians at the clinical level are engaging in practices that might make them money and might be kind of the standard of care, but they're not necessarily leading to healthier outcomes for the patients. And something interesting that you brought up in a previous conversation was around the appendix. Not to just put you on the spot right now, but do you think that, what do you know about the appendix?
I know that it's not so useless as people say. I know that it's considered potentially to be a storehouse of probiotics, and that when the microbiome gets ravaged by whatever antibiotics or some sickness that you might have that flushes you out, that the appendix can resupply the body with the positive beneficial bacteria that it might have lost. So it's like a bank, a seed bank of probiotics, right, potentially. I don't know that for sure, but I do know that that's what some people assert that the use of the appendix is.
Right. Yeah. And I've come across similar literature suggesting that, and framing it in that way, that there's more than meets the eye here, and that potentially, you know, it's not a vestigial, however you say that, organ, and that right, there's definitely some serious significance here. But then when I investigated it more in academia, right, going on Dr. Google, really it's just different search engines that are available where we can read academic papers and just literature that's been published on this. The conclusion that I'm starting to come to is this is actually a pretty significant immunological organ and just plays an active functional role in our immune system. It's not just only used as a bacterial reservoir. It's just an active functioning part of our immune system, like a sentinel node in that region. Yeah, right. So
I believe that's probably, this is bro science,
right? Like you said, it's just total bro science for me right now, at least. I mean, I am reading academic literature and things like that, but I also know that if something's published in a paper, that's, I don't treat that as gospel either.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, so, and I'm missing my appendix, and it's sorely missed. Honestly, I really regret that I had to have mine removed.
And here's the thing is I was almost in that same pipeline, or I was in that pipeline, but I intervened myself and said I wanted to go a different route. Based on the research that I had done, it seemed like in our European counterparts have a very different approach to this problem, where they will either do like a watch and wait approach in rare instances, or prescribe antibiotics. And the last thing you do, and the reason it's the last thing you do, is because the most invasive is amputation of your appendix.
Right. Right.
So anyway, I'm like, man, I really had to step in for myself here and make a case to keep my appendix in. And now I'm thinking, man, I like having my appendix in. I like knowing that it's that guy's in there doing its job, whatever that might be.
Did you have appendicitis and you managed to keep the appendix in spite of the appendicitis?
I'm not even sure if it was appendicitis, because they can't really 100% in many instances diagnose like this is appendicitis. They can make an assumption. And they can give it their best shot to see what possibly this issue is. But I don't think in a lot of cases that they're like surefire, oh, this is an inflammatory thing that's happening. It's strictly in your appendix, or this is a viral or bacterial infection directly in your appendix. Mm-hmm. But I think in some instances they might be able to diagnose that. But at this point in time, and this could be very premature for me to say this, but I am somebody who was going to be pipelined into getting my appendix removed. And I did intervene and chose a different treatment path with antibiotics, which I almost kind of even regret taking those. But because I did experience, but at one point it's like, you know, is my life on the line? I don't really know here. Is my appendix going to blow up inside my body? That's what they make it seem like. And I did feel the antibiotics definitely didn't make me feel great, right, either. And there was a recovery period from antibiotics. So I'm kind of like a my body is a temple kind of guy. I've matured into that the older I've gotten here. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So anyway, that's an element where I'm like, I want us to be preserving and protecting our organs at all costs. And I feel passionate about that. I feel weird for being passionate about that, but I almost just can't fight it anymore. Mm-hmm. Too much. So from a political element, like really it's very challenging to change things internally at the clinical level, I believe. And I think you're running headbutting up against that and experiencing that a little bit. With orthodontists, like they're very hesitant in many instances. A lot of these practicing physicians or orthodontists, they're very hesitant to go against the grain here. So how can we start influencing change? I'm not saying that for the appendicitis and and preserving your appendix and things like that, I don't know the gravity of that situation. I don't really know fully the significance of the appendix to the full extent, or if a lot of these surgeries are necessary or not. But I'm going on that path to figuring it out, because being, you know, when you have surgery, like, first of all, you're getting put under general anesthetic in many instances. I don't think they'd ever use a local. Well, when I really looked into general anesthetics too, I was like, shit, man, that's not like going to sleep. It's like almost like a type of comatose or something. I'm not really sure. I found like there's guaranteed neuronal cell death in your brain. If you're under a general anesthetic too long, that's not good. Like, your brain has to recover from that. Your body has to recover from that. It's not simple going to sleep.
No,
so I wanted
of course
to
not.
Avoid that. Yeah. I wanted to avoid all of that as well. And then I had another situation, not identical to this, but when I was younger, my sister had her tonsils and her adenoids removed. And I've identified those too as profound immunological organs in a very interesting vector or a area too. Look, it's your upper aerorespiratory area where all these pathogens are coming in from. And you have these very powerful immunological nodes in this area. It's very significant immunological organs. These aren't things we can't just amputate because you're not, you know, you're maybe struggling to sleep at night or something. I mean, maybe you need to take drastic steps in certain instances. But the situation that happened with my sister even rubbed me wrong. It felt wrong when I was even a child. I was like, and I was worried about my tonsils being amputated and my adenoids being empty. Even that day, I was telling my parents, like, this is not going to be happening to me, because I was snoring too. I'm like, man, I need to, even at that age, I was like, I literally need to look out for myself. I'm worried that I'm going to get pipelined into a radical amputation of important. I didn't really understand the importance at the time, but I saw the trauma that my sister was going through and was like, I want to avoid this situation. And I don't know if what I said, you know, I don't know if my parents were trying to, you know, see if my tonsils should be removed or something, but that kind of, I think, shaped my psychology going forward, where I felt like it was something very radical that had happened to my sister and I didn't feel like it was necessary even at that age, but I couldn't really put it all together. And now I'm beginning to understand this is possibly an error. This was like possibly because the jaws weren't developing properly. There wasn't great forward growth. So when she was sleeping, it was impacting the airway. The tonsils weren't really the problem. Enlarged tonsils in children. So we amputate them. Which I think it's more the airway is not big enough for possibly.
Of course. You know. Of course, that's right.
So now I'm like, shit. And I can't shake this feeling that I just feel like my sister lost something very important. But I also do think I have a weird psychological profile, not necessarily weird, but I'm very sensitive to these things. I'm like, what are the implications of having four separate immunological organs amputated? Because there's two of your adenoids and two of your, I think, the palatine tonsils in the back. And I'm like, not just for pathogens and things like that. I think these are like T cell factories, like for cancer and all sorts of things.
They could be.
Organs could play. Who knows?
They could be, man. They absolutely could be. And you're right to be totally creeped out. It is kind of like living through a nightmare to see all of these healthy organs ripped out of people.
Right. And this is definitely going to throw you a curveball and possibly make you, or it's going to stop the flow of the conversation.
Try me.
But routine infant circumcision or amputating the foreskin from neonates is also something that I've identified as extremely problematic.
Me too. No, I'm good with all that. It's I don't know why they do it. It makes no sense. I don't see what good comes out of it. But I do know some obvious negative things that come out of it. So I'm totally against circumcision. I think it's insane.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I appreciate you saying that. But yeah, that's an area that I identified also as very problematic. Like, what are the consequences of early infancy penile trauma on neonates when their brain is in such a formulative stage and you're amputating a component of their sexual sensory interface from their body at such a tender and young age? What are the potential psychological, psychosexual consequences of an assault like that on their body. But anyway, that's a very...
It's not good. I would say it's not good. I mean, hopefully in most kids, it's just clumped together with the trauma of being born, which is probably a fucking crazy trauma in and of itself, right? And so maybe it's part of the same blackout. I mean, do they do it right after you come out, or do they wait a couple of days? Because if they waited a couple of days, that would be way worse, right?
Yeah, it's kind of all over the place, actually, but based on what I know. So sometimes it's immediately after birth. Sometimes it's days after, weeks after, months after.
Yeah. I would say if it's a whole separate trauma, it would be way worse, you know. But then look at the traumas that causes guys in their adulthood, right? Like, I think premature ejaculation is definitely linked to circumcision, you know, because if you think about like premature ejaculation, a lot of it has to do with the stimulation of like the top part of your penis, right? And like that's like there's a part of the penis that's at the top that's like ultra sensitive. Like right underneath where the foreskin frenulum would be.
That's what it's called. Yeah.
What is it called?
On the underside, like the bottom of the glands, kind of right here. Like,
yeah, but at the top.
Yeah. So at the top of the glands to like the bottom of this area.
Yeah.
Side, that's the frenular area, the frenulum.
Okay.
And it's a particularly innervated area, or its density and saturation of mechanoreceptors, I think, is possibly different from other regions on the penis. Yeah.
Right. And so normally there would be that foreskin there to provide a buffer between that part of the penis and, you know, the vagina, right? But it's not there. And so it's just constant like hyperstimulation of that region, which is,
right.
It's like you really have to work hard.
It does.
During sex to like mitigate that and try to like, you know what I mean? Not be overstimulated in that region. You got to find angles and you got to like, it's this whole struggle everyone has with this athletic performance of trying to last longer.
Yeah, no, this is kind of a separate conversation. I didn't mean to take the conversation in this direction. I am very interested in having it though. And I really appreciate your willingness to dive into that and just your pursuit. Like, you understand that the pursuit of intellectual understanding of something, it supersedes anything else. Like, it's not uncomfortable because getting to the bottom of this is the most important thing.
Yeah, for sure, man. For sure. And I think another thing you and I have in common is that we share the sort of primal principle or the primal premise, which is like anytime that you violate nature, you can expect some collateral damage.
Right. Well, I would say, I don't want to get into a whole soap opera here, but infant circumcision was something that affected me in a very significant and profoundly negative way. And that had a really powerful impact on how I look at a lot of these other maybe surgeries that amputate organs and things like that. It made me very, very sensitive to that. But the last thing that I'll touch on related to circumcision, which you brought up, and then I do, I would like to move on because it is a challenging subject sometimes for me to talk
about.
It gets emotionally triggering, but what you brought up around premature ejaculation, I think there's definitely some wisdom there, but there's also so much to understand about this subject in terms of what is actually taking place in the quote unquote surgery. Like, just like with female, not that I'm necessarily even trying to equate it at this point in time, with female genital mutilation, people know that there is a spectrum or a range to the tissues and structures that are targeted, or some people do. But no one is really aware that there is a spectrum and a range to how much tissue and what structures are impacted in infant circumcision or juvenile circumcision. So I think in some instances it might cause premature ejaculation, but in some instances, so much of the sensory tissue is removed that it might not result in premature ejaculation. It simply just might result in a situation where there's just very little feedback coming in and,
Oh, it does the opposite.
Yeah. It will like sustain the duration.
Wow.
Longer.
So it basically, it makes it so that you can't feel or like erogenous
sensations. I have an illustration. Yeah, I'm not sure if we can show it on the show, but it would paint an image in your head that will change your understanding of this subject instantaneously.
Maybe you should throw it up because, you know, maybe that might be a nice
illustration that I'm working with an artist on. And that's something that I found that's really interesting, Ron, is to help people build these mental models on like the relationship with our jaws and all these other things. Mm-hmm. They say a picture says 1,000 words or a video. Yeah. It says more than that. Like because I would say that at this point, I'm like an anti-infant circumcision advocate, not to get all political here. But in order to convince people of that position, I needed to find ways to get in the door here or find ways to make powerful and persuasive pitches to people. And something that I found is illustrations do a very good job of illuminating the points that I want to make. And I found that's also the case when I'm trying to talk about things related to the jaw or my teeth. Like it just doesn't click until you have the illustration or animation or something.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah.
People are visual more than they are verbal.
And possibly even more so nowadays with the way we consume media. Like I've even noticed my brain, I used to read so much and could like get into this flow state when I'm reading. The content that I consume has changed so much, like on social media, I notice it's becoming more and more difficult for me to get into that type of mode. But anyway, let me show this illustration real quick. And I know we don't have all the time in the world, so I want to make this point that I'm bringing up here as quickly as possible. I'm not mm-hmm. sure if you've heard of Figma, the design tool, but that's
what no, but I'm very curious to see what.
Well, it's just I put all my illustrations in this here, but let me. Hopefully, this doesn't get demonetized or something on your channel. It is just an illustration though, and you can frame it as like an anatomical illustration. But yes, let me show. How can I share my screen? Oh, here we go. Okay, can you see my screen?
Give me just a second. Now I can.
Okay, cool. Let me see how I can remove the rest of the user interface from this real quick. So I think it's... Okay, so here are two different... So I'm working on a typology system, or a typology system has kind of already been created. And by typology system, I mean the different possible types of circumcision that could exist, or the amount of tissues and structures that are targeted. And the terminology that's going to be used for this typology system is definitely going to evolve over time. This is sometimes what it's referred to as what we see here visually. This is sometimes referred to as the high and tight variation among some people. Mm-hmm. And so let's identify these different areas of the penis real quick. We can clearly see the glands at the top here. And then what do you think this, where the blue line is, what do you think that tissue is?
Well, according to your illustration, it's remaining intermucosal membrane tissue. I don't know what that means.
Right. Where do you think, what kind of tissue do you think the glands is?
I don't know.
Right. So the glands is sometimes referred to as the glands mucosa.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's a mucosal tissue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When we're cut, we really wouldn't know that, or it wouldn't be as obvious because it's exposed. The glands is exposed. So you don't know that it's really actually it should resemble more of like inside of your mouth, or maybe what the inside of the vaginal cavity looks like.
Sort of like a wet tissue.
Yeah, because typically it's not exposed like this. It's typically more of like an internal organ.
Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be buried behind the foreskin.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. You have a good, you got a good mind there to be able to build that construct and understand that. But yes, this is the inner layer. Typically this is the inner layer of the foreskin. And it's all wrapped up, cocooned above the glands. But now you can see on this is an erect version too. it's fully erect, and it's the remaining inner mucosal tissue is strapped down the shaft of the penis pretty much. And it's like taut.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so this is the level of, this is the type of circumcision that I had as an infant. And what I found is that this remaining, first of all, a lot of this inner mucosal membrane tissue has been amputated. It looks like there's a lot there, but it's just because it's strapped down the shaft right here. It's really stretched pretty thin in this variant here. But all of this tissue, what I recognize, this is a part of our sexual sensory platform.
Mm-hmm.
When I was like a child and younger, and when I would masturbate and stuff, I wouldn't even touch the glands. Like I wouldn't even use lube. I would only be stimulating this tissue. So it's like we think of the glands as the primary erogenous zone. But I found that this tissue down below is also just a really a continuation of the glandular mucosal tissue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is another variation that we see over here, the low and tight variation. And it might look less invasive at first, but in this variation, all of this inner mucosal tissue was amputated. And they're actually left with a very minimal amount of their sensory platform left remaining.
Mm-hmm. And so low and tight is much more invasive and much more mutilative than high and tight. Is that right?
Most people would say that because they've lost a significant part of their sexual sensory interface. Mm-hmm. It might not look like that much tissue, right? But when this is the tissue that's, you know, when you stimulate this tissue, I'm still trying to wrap my head around all of this as well. But this is very different tissue than like, if I stimulate my thigh, I'm not feeling sexual sensations,
mm-hmm.
right? But when right. you stimulate this tissue, it really, it's like stimulating your brain in a very unique way. So amputating this tissue from children, from my perspective and the way that I see things, it's an atrocity of the highest possible caliber. Amputating a child's sexual sensory interface and causing early infancy penile trauma. But I'm not trying to take the conversation in this.
No, the conversation is already there. So a lot of guys, you would say they don't even realize that this has been done to them and they're dealing with the fallout of this, but without even realizing what caused it.
I think that's rapidly, you know, I'm projecting my own feelings significantly here, mm-hmm. I would say, but I am in communities with a lot of men that experience significant grievance over this. And I'm one of them. And there's a lot worse than this. If you think of how many men have been subjected to this in the United States, there's a lot of, you know, it's like 70, no one knows the actual metric, but it's possibly like 70% of the men in the United States were circumcised neonatally.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. As of right now, that's rapidly changing with the younger generations. They're much more less likely to subject their child to surgical amputations of their genital tissue. But it is still occurring in pretty significant numbers.
What do you say to this rebuttal that the extra foreskin on the penis harbors bacteria?
You know, I think that's partially true, but I think, Ron, you're immediately aware that our entire body internally and externally is saturated with bacteria.
That's right.
And so I think there is a bacterial biome when you are intact that's different than if you are circumcised. I'm just not the type, I'm not like, ew, bacteria, I'm going to amputate my genital tissue so I have less bacteria. To me, that just seems like the most cartoonishly clown world type of thing. Just an embarrassment for a man to ever say.
It's a farce. It's a farce.
And then you look at women's vaginas and they're discharging blood and smegma and mucus, and even their uterine wall lining decomposes and comes out of their vaginal mucosal cavern. And I thought as men were supposed to be, even though I don't even agree with this, but aren't as men, we're supposed to be a little more comfortable with these things, our biological thing, but apparently not men who want our penis modification positive. I don't really know how to describe that psychological mind state. I'm not a man who wants my penis modified though. you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, no, neither am I. And I would never do it to my son. I would never, ever, ever subject my son to that. Why do they do it, man? Where does this all come from? What's the history of that?
It's not good. It's really the deeper you go down this rabbit hole, it just gets worse and worse, actually.
Is there a sinister history to this?
I would say so, based on the research that I've done in the United States. It does look like that there was a puritanical, in the United States at least, I don't think this is ever going to be conclusively understood, what all went down here. But in the early 1900s, it seems like it's when this really started to proliferate in the United States or become more of a practice that was medicalized in pediatrics. Actually, pediatrics modern pediatrics, I believe, in the United States was conceptualized around the early 1900s by a man actually by the name of Abraham Jacoby. I think he's considered like the godfather of pediatrics in the United States, and also played a role in obstetrics of some kind. But anyway, from my perspective, and it is a little too premature to say this actually at this point in time, but I do think that a significant component of why early people in the United States circumcised infants was because they understood that it was like a religious thing, even though it was primarily being done by Christians. This like cleanliness is next to godliness, right? Maybe you've heard that saying. I don't want to, you know, I'm scared to present this side of things, even though I think there's a truth to it. I'm like a coward right now and I can't get into it because I'm worried about like my personal reputation and stuff.
They thought that making someone capable of erogenous experience would incline them to sin. Is that the idea?
Kind
of so, like how they do female genital mutilation in other parts of the world.
What they found is that initially it was a lot of times being done on young children, actually not infants. It'd be done on young children caught masturbating, and they would amputate a portion or all of the foreskin in order to impact the masturbatory practice that the child was doing. And it does, when you think about it, when you amputate that skin, that mucosal skin system, the way that our penis is supposed to be stimulated is the movements of the foreskin up and down the glands in the shaft. And I'm right now restoring, which is a practice of trying to stretch out the remaining foreskin that you have to have coverage, erect coverage. At least that's the goal that I'm looking for. And why I'm looking for that goal is because I think the natural range of motion that we should have on our penises is the movement of the foreskin up and down the glands in the shaft. It's like tightly hugging the glands in an ideal development. It hugs the gland and goes down and it stimulates it's like all mucosal tissue underneath it. And it's stimulating the glands as well. It's like the proper way we're supposed to experience, in my opinion, as a man, sexual stimulation is from the inner foreskin stimulating the glands and the glands stimulating the inner foreskin. And now that I've been restoring, I'm like, shit, that is a radical difference. Or that experience is very, very different. And even though it's never going to be the same, like the tissue I'm restoring, I would say that I'm becoming increasingly more aggravated by this practice the more that I restore and recognize that and I think some people could think like, oh, he's just interested in sexual pleasure and he wants, he wants increased sexual pleasure and that's weird. No, what I want is the normal sexual pleasure that I should have in my normal range of motion for the sexual mechanics and stuff. I want the body I was supposed to be born with here and not this modified situation for myself. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah.
So men suffering from the worst of circumcision, what is that like? Is it about the fact that they can't experience any kind of sexual stimulation?
I think it's a couple of different areas. I wouldn't say in most instances people are fully restricted from feeling sexual sensation if they're circumcised. We know that's not the case. But there is, if you're higher up on that spectrum of how much tissue was removed and how invasive it was. I also had my frenulum fully amputated on the underside of my penis. So an area that's known as being particularly erogenous was, it almost looks like a separate incision was made and it was just hacked off.
Fuck. So that would be like the most extreme version of a circumcision. Not quite. The high and tight is more extreme.
Yeah. I would say the low and tight one that we saw is the most. When all of that inner mucosal tissue is amputated and you have no movement and it's just the glands, and there's no ability for the foreskin to move up and down the glands, that's pretty much the most radical. Without it being like a botch, I would say that's considered the most invasive form of genital cutting, mm-hmm. in terms of circumcision.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow, man, this is incredibly upsetting. And to me, it's almost like extractions, but for male genitals.
But this is just one lens. I would say for you and anyone else watching it, don't take what I'm saying as gospel. That's how we get in these situations, right? Where we just take what one person says and introduce it into our framework and just move on. I think there's a lot to this, and I would recommend people do their own research. Don't just look at what are the benefits of circumcision, though. Look at what is the role and function that the foreskin plays in male sexual anatomy. Like, you could say, oh, you know, you very well could reduce the risk of sexually transmitted diseases if potentially, I don't even think this is the jury's out in my opinion. But if you remove a large portion of the mucosal tissue, which is kind of known to be maybe more permeable in a way, I'm not sure, but we know that pathogens maybe can get through the mucosal tissues easier than regular skin.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So if you remove a large portion of that mucosal tissue, then I mean, it seems like there's less surface area maybe for, I'm just, bro science in it here right now.
Yeah, you're coming up with a rebuttal to the argument that circumcision prevents STDs.
Yeah, well, I haven't even presented that argument. I'm saying I think there could be possibly some truth to that. I just don't give a shit. Like, what if you could remove your chances of ocular cancer if you remove your eyeballs? Well, that's not for me. I'm not going to remove my eyeballs to reduce. So it's really like the cost-benefit analysis was flawed here.
The foreskin,
from my opinion, is a very, very important part of male sexual anatomy. Mm-hmm. And that this is a structure that we should preserve and protect, and senselessly amputating it from newborns is extremely problematic, both for their quality of life and then the trauma.
Yeah.
Anyway, somebody, I see a comment here, whole body breathing. I didn't want to be, not just like, I obviously want to talk about this all day, but your audience might not want to talk about this all day.
No, my audience is super interested in it. And I think I'm actually glad that we were able to take a deep dive on this subject, because I think it's totally related to jaw hacks and to wisdom teeth and premolar extraction. And I personally have learned a ton on this call. I do have to jump, Carter, to my next call. But whoa, like, that was a hell of a deep dive on what I think is a very important issue, man.
Jeez, I'm feeling like emotional right now. I really appreciate you holding space for this, because I get so much shit for bringing that topic up. So I really appreciate you being so open to hearing more about it.
Oh, man. I think we're getting a lot of positive feedback. And I think you might be surprised at how many people didn't even realize that this was a hot topic issue that has affected their life for all these years, and is definitely in the same category as some of the orthodontic mutilation that they've experienced.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I know you got to go here. I would love, an opportunity to possibly chat in the future. I'm not sure, there were some things related to sleep that I want to chat about as well. And I know you got to go, but one thing I want to say is, what are your thoughts on sleeping on your back? Here, let me show something real quick.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we can touch on that here in the next couple of minutes.
Because what I'm finding, let me go. Actually,
yes.
Yeah. So
you're tall. What are you? 6'2", 6'3"?
No, I would say
six.
You know what's funny is I've never really weighed, done a proper analysis of my height, but I'd say probably 5'10", 5'11".
You look a lot taller than that just now.
I appreciate it. But so have you ever tried sleeping on your back on a hard surface?
Yes, I have. I did it for several years.
Yep. Were you able to did you ever feel like you were able to get in a comfortable, like on a hard surface, not on a bed, just completely laying flat on your back on a hard surface, and you were able to accomplish that?
I did it for years and I don't think it was a positive experience for me. I don't advocate that form of sleeping now.
Okay.
I might be open to it on an.
I'm probably going on the same journey you're going down, because what I feel is some interesting biofeedback shit where I can get into a mewing position so easily, and it just is natural when I'm on my back. Mm-hmm. It feels very organic, and it feels like it's when I'm on my back, I feel like all of these things that are subconscious that make it easy to mew, and I'm almost getting into a chin tuck naturally. Mm-hmm. And then I think, how did people sleep back in the prehistoric days?
Yeah.
I think
they slept on the earth on an incline with their head on the higher side of the incline. And I think unless they had really good jaws, and probably most of them did back in the day, I think they slept with their face to the side while on their back.
Right.
Because that opens up your airway.
Okay.
Really profoundly. And it also makes it so your tongue isn't directly fighting gravity.
Interesting.
Well, yeah, that's what I do now. I sleep on my back with my head to the side on an incline.
So let me show. This is the last thing we'll finish off on here. But I want to show you, because I think I have a solution for this that I'm going to try tonight. Ron went monk mode for years.
It's true.
What does that really mean, monk mode? You were
Well, I was literally living with monks at a Buddhist monastery.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
No way.
But I think what Karen is referring to here is sleeping on primitive hard surfaces.
Gotcha. All right. I'll be right back. This will take 1 second. I'm going to get this.
Yeah, it does. It does, Karen. It does feel really good. Yeah, flat surfaces are not common in nature. If you, let's say you go on a long hike and at the end of the day, you're looking for a place to pitch your tent, it's actually really hard to find a flat surface to pitch your tent. You know, you need to pitch your tent on flat earth so that if it rains, the bathtub floor of your tent doesn't get flooded out, so that the water you don't create a river underneath you. But it's actually really hard to find flat surfaces in nature. And if we are sleeping on a non-flat surface, we will always naturally choose to sleep with our head up high and our feet down low. Yeah, go ahead, Carter.
So what I'm going to show is...
What state are you in, Carter? Just curious. Where are you?
Phoenix, Arizona.
Arizona? Cool.
Yeah, Phoenix specifically, which is important to know, because this is I live in a desert... a desert climate, pretty much. Mm-hmm, a Sahara desert type of situation here. But I want to show a position that I'm putting myself in that is maximizing kind of this biofeedback for me to mew properly. And it's this right here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A big part of why I can't sleep comfortably on my back is because my core and my hip flexors and my anterior pelvic tilt is preventing me from getting in a proper comfortable position. But I'm wondering if I can sleep on my back properly, and that exercise does seem to be helping me build the correct muscles to feel more comfortable sleeping on my back. Well, if I can mew 8 hours every single night, that seems pretty significant. Like get in a good mewing position for 8 hours every single night. Right now, I'm sleeping on my stomach with my face like just right in the pillow. Mm. That's the worst sleeping position. I know that's causing issues, and I'm grinding my teeth, and my teeth never feel like they're in a proper occlusion and things like that. So
yeah. Hey, experiment with it. But what I would recommend is use the SnoreLab app just to keep yourself honest, because in my experience, it's very easy to deceive yourself about how well you're actually sleeping. And you might wake up and feel okay, but it turns out you snored for 2 or 3 hours the night before. So you always have to be giving yourself an objective metric of how your sleep is. And I like to use the SnoreLab app for that. I did experiment for a long time with sleeping on a firm floor, flat on my back, face up. Didn't work out for me. My throat just closes when I sleep flat on my back. I think sleeping on an incline helps the throat not collapse under the force of gravity. And then when we tilt our head to the side on that incline, it actually opens up the airway pretty profoundly and also opposes gravity too. And so that's kind of where I'm at. And I've been getting really good results with sleeping like that for about the past 2 years. So that's kind of where I'm at. But what I would say is keep experimenting, man. And take your own path. Take your own path.
It's a journey. I might kind of film it, but record or give progress updates on or try to maybe make YouTube videos or something like that, seeing if there's any progress there and I'm able to sleep on my back correctly and get into a proper mewing position and things like that. You know, I'd love to share that knowledge with other people, kind of like you're doing. But yeah, it's definitely a journey of finding these proper positions and postural changes and practices to optimize those.
For sure. Maybe one tweak that you could consider implementing at some point is instead of sleeping flat on the earth, just get like a 4x8 sheet of plywood, which is also very firm. Prop that up and then sleep on that incline. So it would basically be like a very firm, hard surface, but with a slight incline. That might be the next iteration for you.
That's some interesting.
That's what I would do. If I were going to sleep on a hard surface, I would get a 4x8 sheet of plywood and incline it.
Actually probably what I'm going to, that's a very cheap solution to try out. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Carter, I have a 240. So I got you, man.
Yeah, I got you.
I've enjoyed this tremendously. You are a wealth of knowledge, keep going, man. And can't wait to see what other kind of brilliance you produce in your pursuit for truth and health.
Cool, man. Yeah, no, that was great feedback. This was a great conversation for me and motivated me a ton to invest more into this, actually. And I think, you know, we have similar like psychological frameworks I don't find many people who think like you. And I want to keep finding this community.
Yeah, hell yeah.
So I'm glad you're cultivating this here. Mm-hmm. And we're finding a lot of like-minded people coming together and saying, hey, some things at the clinical level maybe can be improved here.
Understatement of the day.
Yeah.
No, for sure, man. I love having you as part of the community, and let's keep in touch.
All right. Sounds good, Ron. Take care. Have a good rest of your day.
All right. Take care, Carter. Bye-bye. Yeah.